serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the unique story of a Merchant Marine veteran named Chuck Ferriter. He's pretty well known in Claremont, California, where he spent more than six decades. He built quite a few homes and senior apartments there, and he has impacted countless lives. But his life was almost cut short before he ever ended up in the Golden State. We heard about how a deadly snowstorm, rerouted train cars, and a little old lady conspired to connect him with a young nurse named Muriel. Read his book, it's linked for you online, for the improbable manner in which Chuck ended up with some time to pursue Muriel in Hawaii while she worked at a hospital there. And listen now as he explains why he would end up needing her more than he could ever imagine.
During the Korean War, we were coming from Europe with troops, Belgique, Turkish, Norwegian, just the UN.
It was a UN effort, so yeah. You had troops from many different countries, and you're bringing them from Europe to Korea.
To Korea. Got orders to go to Guam to pick up, call it a half-track, with four old-fashioned machine guns on it. What they needed them for, the Chinese, they would make 500-man charges in the middle of the night, all firing automatic weapons.
So you guys went to Guam to pick up these armored vehicles that would have the machine guns to go against them.
To stop those 500-man charges. So we pulled into Incheon Harbor, and they were loaded on the deck of a troop ship, all tied down. They did that all at the shipyard on Guam. When we got there, they left everybody on sea watches, but the deck sea watch had to help with the unloading crew. And I had four guys in my crew. The crane that they had sent was what they called a dog leg crane. It hung like that in the air, and it wasn't tall enough to handle the pick when they made it. And the pick would just go crazy, banging on things here and there. And they devised a system of, took the cargo cables on the ship and tied two of them on the opposite sides of the load to kind of keep it from flying around. And it worked. But my crew got this assigned to doubling the hawser that was holding the cargo barge in place. It was on the opposite side of the crane. Our ship, dogleg crane, and the barge, the wind came up, and that barge was threatening to break loose. So we went and doubled that hawser that was holding it. We got it done. And we were standing, I was standing on the bollard, a big cast iron thing that to put ropes around to tie the ship to. I was standing up on top of it to see what I had been doing. And somebody screamed, "Look out, look out." And I looked out and turned, and one of those machines was coming at me 100 miles an hour, and it was about an arm's length away. So I, just right from the position I was in, I just threw myself over the side of the ship. I was afraid to try to drop down because I didn't know whether that thing was going to land, or it looked like it could.
So this half-track is going to crash into you or crush you if you don't do something.
If I don't do something. So I jumped over the side. And as soon as I did it, I remembered the lecture from my survival training bosun mate at Sheepshead Bay. He said, "One thing you never ever do is jump off your ship. Never, never jump off your." And I just did it. And of course, I had no idea where I was going to land. I knew if I landed on that steel deck of that crane, it was all over. So I had accepted death without any problem. But it didn't land on the deck. I landed in the water and immediately went 30 feet deep, probably. I could see our ship. The hull was painted red. I could see the crane. It had furry stuff all over the bottom, seaweed stuff. And the barge, it was clean. They were like toys up there. I knew, again from survival training, that the air in my clothes would bring me up once, but only once. When I finally stopped going down, and because I fell from so far, almost 40 feet, it blew the air out of my lungs and my skin on my backside and side of my head. It was all black and blue instantly. And I had somehow bit my cheek inside, and it was bleeding like hell. And how do you spit blood out without letting water in?
Right.
You figure it out real quick, and it worked.
You fall from 40 feet. You don't even know yet how severe your injuries are going to be, but you've got to make it back to the surface or you're a goner.
Well, you know you're going to come up once. You've been told that. The air in your clothes will bring you up once. And when I came up, I was looking at a scene that became a PTSD thing. My friend, who was standing in front of me, and the damn thing clipped his legs off, you know, between the gunwale of the ship and the tracks of the machine. And just instantly I knew that his legs were cut off because he was lying on his back without any problem. And this is another thing you learn in survival training. Your legs are what pulls you under. They have no air in them. The rest of your body, even in your head, there's air. When I saw him laying like that without any problem trying to stay on, I knew his legs were gone. And there was a big purple cloud forming around him. But I'm spellbound by this scene, and he was trying to talk to me. He was looking at me with his eyes open, trying to talk to me, but he was making little sounds like a small animal might make. So I'm spellbound by this thing, scene I'm looking at, and I'm hearing the sounds he's making, not words. They were just not words. They were just little chirps and squeaks. And
so all his body had the strength to get out.
Yeah. So the guys on the barge were throwing life jackets on the water, and instead of going and getting one, I'm spellbound by the scene I'm looking at and hearing, and eventually it was too late. I went to try to get to it. I missed the last one. The first one that I came to, I just missed it and went under. And there's no coming back the second time. But when I got down about almost to where daylight stops, it's about 30 feet is when you begin to lose daylight. It depends on the water. But I got to a point where I seemed like I had stopped, and I looked up, and there was a beautiful aluminum-painted hook coming down. The guys on the crane, you know, you can't throw a rope on the water. It'll float. It won't go in. But they put a steel cable with a hook on it over the side, and it was coming down. So I waited for it to get there, and I grabbed it and yanked on it to let them know they had a hook, and they yanked me up out of there.
So if they hadn't seized that moment and reacted on the spot with that ingenuity, you've got two kids that never would have been born, grandkids, and a beautiful red-headed great-granddaughter here who wouldn't be here.
That's true.
Wow.
That's all true. But you can't dwell on it or think too much about it.
But you had no choice for a while because your injuries were pretty significant.
Yeah, I had no idea what was wrong, but my legs weren't working. Turned out I had major injuries in my spine just from the fall. A lot of hurt from the fall, black and blue, and I was really badly bruised. It's like falling on, not concrete, but like falling on grass when you fall in the water.
So that must have been a very delicate situation to try to get you the medical care you needed.
Well, they didn't know what to do with me. The ship's doctor came around every day. I was already in sick bay. I kind of went into shock, I think, or something. And the next day I was told that my friend had died and that I had, they called it internal injuries. The fact that my legs wouldn't work was a big concern.
Yeah, you don't know if they're ever going to work again.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That occurred to me over many hours. And nobody knew enough to lie to me. Everything's going to be okay. Nobody did because they were scared to death.
They just let you marinate in that fear and uncertainty.
Yeah.
How long were you in the hospital?
Well, it took 40 days to get back to New York. The ship's doctor wanted to put me ashore in the Philippines. But the skipper and I knew about Clark Field. We had put a guy ashore there a couple of years before, and they had cut his leg off. It was Civil War medicine. So the skipper wouldn't let the doctor put me ashore there. He said we'd got to take him back to New York. That's where his best bet is. By the time I got there, I had lost about 40 pounds, and this leg had atrophied to the point, I guess something was cut off or something, and it just was like an arm.
Your left leg was shriveled up to that degree.
Yeah.
And did you have any control of your legs by now?
No.
So you get to New York, you still can't move your legs.
I was in traction. It was a spring. The carpenter fixed it up. He put door springs on it.
People are starting to understand why I referred to you as a walking miracle. So you finally get to Staten Island, and then what?
Well, on the way ashore, I pleaded with the first mate to call Muriel and her mother. They called to let them know that I would be at the hospital. But a strange thing happened there, all part of this miracle thing. The guy driving the ambulance is an old guy. He rolled my gurney onto the deck, went through a door, and there was a well-lit corridor there. He rang the bell, and then he came over to me and said, "Welcome home, young man." And I cried.
I have to imagine that the uncertainty of your future had to feel overwhelming.
Yeah, and Muriel.
You don't know if she's going to come, she's going to see you, she's going to still want to be with you?
When she came, did you read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Uh-huh.
We had a Nurse Cratchit. And Nurse Cratchit, when Muriel and her mom came and went, she came and planted herself at my door and announced to everybody on the third floor, "Would you believe that pretty Jersey girl is going to marry that basket case in 301? And I wanted to go kill her, but I was strapped in bed. I was hoping somebody else would, but nobody did. I eventually began to see it as funny.
And I know, Chuck, that this has been your life, and this is a story you've written about in your book, and you've told it a time or two. But when you think about that sailor in that hospital bed with this destroyed spinal area, and that girl who loves you enough to say, "I don't know what your future's going to look like, but I'm going to be part of it." How incredible is that?
It was incredible, and it's exactly what happened. And it didn't happen until I was being discharged with this crazy brace on.
Yeah, tell me about that brace.
Well, it was steel with leather, and it went around my hips, and there was I called it a beam in the back, rod. There was a little mattress on my front, and the mattress was laced with a big heavy shoestring to the beam that was in the back so that I couldn't move an inch. I mean, my body was, my legs moved, and, well, this one had a problem, but...
The left one was still weak from the atrophy?
Yeah.
But they were moving again?
But they didn't function. I couldn't stand on them or anything.
So that's the shape that you get discharged in?
Yeah, I was being discharged with this goofy brace on, and my legs were working to the point where I could walk behind a chair and push it. But I didn't know until the moment, practically, that I was going out the door that I said I had to wear this brace. And I went back in and asked the doctor. He said, "We don't have the skill here to get you out of it. It's saving your life." And Muriel understood it when he explained it. He explained it to her. I said to her, "Muriel, you didn't fall in love with a guy that is in a monster brace like this. You go home and tell your mom that it's all over and it's okay." She said, "Chuck, you got to get used to the idea. You're stuck with me." It was incredible.
Kind of sounds like a line from a movie, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And maybe they ought to make a movie. You've written the book.
She said it.
You were wearing that stylish brace for your wedding?
Yeah. It didn't show under my suit coat. We went on our honeymoon, came back to Jersey and packed up and went to California. And when we got here, I was having trouble with this left leg. So Muriel looked up in phone book where the Naval Hospital was. So it was in North Long Beach. We went in there and the doctor, he did what he could for my problem. And Muriel said, "What's with this brace? Why can't you people take it off?" And he said, "We don't have the skill to do it. It's saving his life." And that's kind of the way it was. But she never let him off the hook. She just kept after him. When she bugged him about it, he said, "We don't have anyone with the skill, but there is a little old guy over here. He says, I think he's retired, but he's still working. His name is Moshe B. Taylor." She had his name and address written down by then, and we were there 3 days later. And Moshe B. Taylor, a tiny little Jewish man, that said to Muriel, "Young lady, you have to be scared to death of the future, but I'm so happy to tell you that I can fix him. Me and two pigs." He says, "The pigs won't know about it, but they'll be there." I guess I was 2 or 3 months in White Memorial Hospital in East Los Angeles. And when I came out of there, I was carrying that brace under my arm. Somehow he was able, or knew how, to shave that pig bone to a point where it could readily weld itself to my bones. I guess pigs and people have very similar bones, but to just physically do it was scaring those other doctors away.
So using pig bones, he added them to your existing spinal structure to give you the stability that you could walk and do everything else that you wanted to do without that brace.
Yeah.
How crazy does that sound, Chuck?
Yeah, miracle crazy.
Uh-huh. But it worked.
Yeah, it worked. When I walked out of there, I was carrying the brace.
You must have felt like $1 million.
Yeah, sure did.
And none of it would have happened without that good-looking nurse right here in this photo on your nightstand.
That's the truth. And I got another story regarding her and her mother. I talked about this picture I was looking at when I, instead of getting my life jacket.
That traumatic scene of your friend with his legs cut off in the water.
And talking to me.
Right.
When our baby was Kathleen, she was born, Muriel had her in a little bassinet close to our bed. I would wake up in the middle of the night, wide awake and hearing the sound that I had heard.
Of your friend trying to form words and talk to you.
Of course, she was making the noises that little babies make. And I got to the point where I decided the thing to do is to get up and very quietly go out in the backyard and talk to the dog. And the dog seemed to want me to talk to him. He would look at me, and it was just amazing. He tried his best to get me to tell him what the problem was. Anyway, Muriel's mom came out to help with the baby. She began to realize that this thing was going on in the night.
That you were having these recurring flashbacks to that traumatic scene.
Well, she didn't have any idea what was going on, but she knew I was going out in the backyard at night.
Uh-huh.
With the dog. She had no training in PTSD. It didn't even have a name.
Right.
But she just knew somehow, she was a nurse, whatever was wrong needed to be talked about. She just kept asking questions. I eventually told her that there's a scene that I see at night that I couldn't not see. It's just there, and I've got to look at it. Guys that don't shoot themselves,
right.
Guys that don't want to see it again, and that's still happening.
Yes.
They don't have Muriel's mom to help them. But she would keep asking questions and trying to get a handle on it, and eventually I described the scene for her without making a decision to do it. It just happened. Probably 4 days later, I'd stop seeing it.
And never saw it again?
Never saw it again. Well, I can see it in my mind, but...
If you want to.
Yeah.
Boy, Chuck, I can't help but listen to all this and think that you've had some kind of life.
And I had a lot of fun, and I was helped so often by so many.
And how long were you and Muriel married before you lost her?
She died in the 65th year of our marriage, 65 years.
And I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. I don't think anyone's ever heard a story quite like this before. But when you think back over almost 95 years now, come September, you're hitting that 95 mark.
Yeah.
What are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I couldn't have not had those experiences without that guy on the phone, Merchant Marine recruiter, saying, get on a train and come down and see us. It kind of all started right there, after he found out I was a cowboy.
Right.
I'm most proud of this young lady.
That young lady, of course, his late wife, Muriel. If you visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of Chuck holding his favorite photo of that pretty young nurse he met in such unique fashion. You'll also find that link to his book in The Gentle Blue Light of the Dog Star, which Chuck hopes might help others facing PTSD. Chuck also had more to say that we couldn't quite fit into our radio time, so you'll find that in the podcast version of this episode online. We're out of time for now, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.